This holiday, BMW has reunited three members of the family at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. The Agile X3, engineered for any adventure. The plug-in hybrid X5, commanding the streets with unmatched presence. And the all-electric i4, charging into the future with impeccable performance. Hurry in to find what powers your journey at the BMW Roadhome Sales Event. BMW, the ultimate driving machine.
Hurry in for exceptional offers through December 2nd. Visit BMWUSA.com for details.
It's better over here.
AT&T customers, switching to T-Mobile has never been easier. We'll pay off your existing phone and give you a new one free. All on America's largest 5G network. Visit T-Mobile.com/carrierfreedom to switch today.
Pay off up to $650 via virtual prepaid MasterCard in 15 days. Free phone up to $830 via 24 monthly bill credits plus tax. Qualifying port-in trade-in service on Go5G Next and credit required. Contact us before canceling entire account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance and required finance agreement is due.
I'm Jed Lipinski. In Gone South Season 4, we'll be bringing you new stories every week with no end in sight. Listen to and follow Gone South, an Odyssey original podcast, on the free Odyssey app and wherever you get your podcasts.
Artificial intelligence has been one of the most common phrases in our society of late. But is it a tool to make our lives better or something to be feared? I'm Matt Bigler with Odyssey News Station KCBS in San Francisco, where my colleagues and I will be taking you on a journey across Silicon Valley to explore this artificial revolution and consider, is the future automation? Welcome to Silicon Valley, the greater San Jose, California region in the San Francisco Bay Area. For more than a century, it's been the hub of research and innovation from the early days of radio and now the hub of major tech firms like Apple, Alphabet, Google, Meta, Facebook, Nvidia, and many, many more, pushing the boundaries on tech's role in our lives and in our future.
It's the best iPhone that we have ever created.
Today, those four companies are among the seven most valuable in the world, largely fueled by their role in developing artificial intelligence. But the new world of AI presents new challenges.
We need to take responsible steps to ensure fair competition and open markets, to protect privacy, human rights, civil liberties, to make sure that advanced AI systems are safe and trustworthy.
Ben Beharin is a Silicon Valley-based tech analyst. Ben, this term AI is bounced around quite a bit, but is what we're seeing out there really artificial intelligence?
Oh, sure. No, it's a great place to start. And, you know, it kind of feels like one of those philosophical discussions, right, to start. Because you're right, there's a lot of ways to look at this. I think people who have been in this field for a long time look at some of the generative AI stuff that we have today, which is really just, I would say, some form of advanced, to use a technical term, matrix multiplication, which just means that if you put in a word, it's essentially going to try to predict the next word or just string together logic of sentence structure and a whole host of other things, right? And that's just simple like math that's happening on our compute engines. No, nobody would call that intelligence, right? Being able to say, write me an essay on so-and-so and so, you know, topic, and it just goes to the internet and conforms, you know, forms something that looks readable. You know, again, it's automating a process. It's not really what we would sort of call intelligent. So I think there's a gap today as to what this idea is of where we'll go, where something might be truly intelligent, you know, maybe even able to do or come up with ideas, concepts, creative ideas that humans can't, or on the level with humans. That is not where we're at today. But I think the way I would look at least today is that it's more of an augmentation type of intelligence. So you're able to have it help you do things, help you, you know, write an email for you, right, in your tone. Again, not intelligent, that's a useful feature, but that's essentially augmenting a function of a task that a human does with a computer. And that's, we can go down this path of, well, is that the ultimate reality here, that it's more just an augmented type of intelligence designed to make humans more efficient? Or are we going down this path where something's going to be independently sentient, where you hear people talk about this idea of, you know, artificial general intelligence? So I don't know. I know a lot of people are chasing this, you know, sentient. I think that's a long, 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 long way off. But the idea that this is now just augmenting us in helpful, quasi-useful ways, right? That's the world that we're at today with this, you know, quote-unquote term, artificial intelligence. We were always compute constrained, right? There's been natural language engines that essentially, you know, you could kind of talk to a robot that could get information, right? You've seen some of this stuff with call centers, but they were very limited. And I think people very easily knew that this was a robot, right? This was a bot. But that was a compute constrained, very specific type of use case.
We'll check in with Ben again for more in a bit. So who and what are building this artificial intelligence? I decided to take a trip to one of Silicon Valley's education hubs, San Jose State University, where students and professors are eagerly learning all about AI.
My name is Trevor Basil. I'm lecture faculty here in psychology, and then I'm the AI postdoc fellow working with the AI for Civic and Social Good Initiative.
What is demand like right now? How many classes are there? How are classes changing, given that AI just sort of burst on the scene a couple of years ago?
Yeah, what a cool question. I think there's a ton of pressure, obviously, from external sources, like industry. There's probably an equal amount of pressure from the administration, right? Where are we going? How are we preparing students? There's obviously a great awareness of that in computer engineering and a lot of the STEM courses, but this is slowly trickling into every other type of course. So being a psychology professor, they didn't come into college with a great interest in AI, but now it's kind of being thrust upon them. But also they have access to everything, right? So it's really an interesting kind of slow bleed into just absolutely every part of the entire university. So the demand is high and it's growing, and I think students are really understanding that they need to be AI fluent, not AI experts, as they go into their careers.
What's your name?
Ankita Modak.
And you are a graduate student?
Yes, I'm an international student here at San Jose State. I'm from India, and I'm a graduate student studying mass communication.
Hi, my name is Brianna. I'm a grad student as well, studying mass communications here at San Jose State.
What is your interest in using artificial intelligence to do what you want to do easier, more accurately?
I see AI as a technical advancement that has happened in the past, like something like an internet or social media. Like, it revolutionized how we see things and what we do on a daily basis. Like, nowadays we wake up and the first thing we do is go on social media. So it's going to be integrated, like, into our daily routine. So I just see this as a revolution.
What are you using AI for here at San Jose State?
Sometimes I use it to structure my emails, write email responses for research purposes.
What are you using AI for?
So for me, since I'm a writer, I'm a creative storyteller. I use AI as a tool for writing purposes, to generate ideas, just like facilitate my work a little bit better. But I also agree with Ankita. I feel like it's not very nuanced. Sometimes it doesn't articulate my ideas the way that I would do it. So I also have to do a lot of fact checking to make sure like all the sources are straight. I really like focusing on the social media aspect of AI as well, since we're studying mass communications. So something I would really like to learn more about is content moderation, how people are regulating this type of technology.
Do you guys feel like you have the tools that you need to learn how to become well-versed in AI here at San Jose State?
Well, in our department, I don't think that AI has spread across. Like, we're just talking about it, what is gonna happen, what might happen, and not really learning on how to tackle that.
Yeah, I feel like a lot of classes in our department as well are very new, like relatively new. At least three classes I'm taking this semester are new classes that have never been developed before, and they're all surrounding like AI and social media and mass communications. And a lot of my relatives who take who have taken programs at San Jose State, none of these classes have been around for them because it wasn't relevant in the past. So I feel like this is a very like new technology that a lot of more students like should be learning about.
Next, we are going to explore how AI is not just a tool for work, but also an experience, helping us to get where we need to go and making our lives easier and more comfortable at home.
We'll be right back to Artificial Revolution, an Odyssey conversation on KYW News Radio. This is Artificial Revolution, an Odyssey conversation on KYW News Radio.
Ben, how much of what we're hearing and experiencing with AI is the key to future innovation, and how much of it is just marketing?
Again, right, it comes down to what are going to be the fundamental use cases that that people use these things for. And I think every industry category, right, from medical to coding to industry to teaching, we're just starting to scratch, you know, the very beginning of this from a surface level.
With all of this development and innovation, it needs to be tested somewhere. And that somewhere is often just north of Silicon Valley itself in San Francisco. Some of the biggest recent test projects have been self-driving cars. Standing on a San Francisco street, you might not notice that some cars passing you have no drivers. Mike DeWald with Odyssey News Station KCBS rode along with one Californian who decided to give the self-driving rideshare company Waymo a try.
The prospect of hopping into a moving car with no driver for some can be scary, for others intriguing.
When I first moved here, just seeing these cars with the giant cameras spinning and no one in the driver's seat.
Logan Pratt moved to San Francisco 3 years ago.
I've definitely been wanting to try it. I just haven't really found the right time or made the effort to.
We joined Logan on his first Waymo ride in San Francisco. We called up the app, which told us there would be a 6-minute wait. On the way, running into a protest.
We know what you do.
More on that in a moment. Right on time, we found our vehicle parked and waiting.
Here we go. Wow. Handle comes out for us. That's just fantastic.
The car giving a welcoming greeting with relaxing music.
Sounds like I'm in a spa.
Surprisingly, the car also acknowledging what we encountered on the walk here.
Our team is aware of the interruption to your ride.
With that, we were off. The most obviously notable feature, no driver.
This is so odd. There's just no one in the front seat.
The car maneuvering an average day of city traffic without issue.
It's cool how the wheel is just like making like all these micro adjustments. So far, steady ride.
A digital panel on the center console shows a detailed map of everything around.
That has a whole view of every car, even their blinkers.
We may use interior cameras to check on riders, improve our products, and more. But our microphones are only on when you're connected to rider support.
This Waymo passes the test of a 5-way intersection.
That was actually kind of a complicated intersection.
That was a very complicated intersection. I would be a little stressed myself driving across that one.
The alternative, ride-hail services with a driver, have their positives and negatives.
You know, sometimes you get a weird driver, their car smells bad. Sometimes you're like, when did this person learn how to drive yesterday?
But then there's the benefits of local knowledge of the neighborhoods.
In cases of emergency, like, you kind of do need a human.
Then about halfway through, it happened. A moment of seeming confusion as the car pulled up behind a large truck offloading.
Uh-oh. Now we're getting beeped at. All right, let's see if it goes now. Oh. There you go. I thought we were going to be stuck there.
It took a couple minutes, but crisis ultimately averted.
I don't think I've ever done that.
That made a choice right there, because we had to go into oncoming traffic.
Yeah, that was just right over the double yellow.
With that, we reached our destination.
Look at that. It pulls over off onto a side road.
You're here. Please make sure it's clear before exiting.
A successful, roughly 40-minute ride equating to an $18 fare.
Ride one complete. What's the assessment?
It was great. I thought I would be scared. but I wasn't.
Pratt admits, despite a smooth ride, there are some elements that are tough to get used to.
Seeing no human in the driver's seat was very weird.
Is that the sort of the hardest thing to overcome?
Yeah, it's just weird. Like, I've never been in a car without someone in the driver's seat while it's driving, so it's just like, who's driving me right now?
Still, Pratt says he's up for using the Waymo service more regularly.
Whoever coded it to drive us, I guess they're doing a good job, so props to you guys in Waymo.
Waymo's autonomous vehicles aren't alone on the streets of San Francisco. Zoox's ramping up testing of its more shuttle-like robo-taxis here and on the Las Vegas Strip. The first chance for the public to ride will come next year, but only in Sin City.
So, where do you go after a self-driving Waymo ride? How about the ultimate smart house in the Silicon Valley town of Los Gatos?
My name is Gordon Van Zuyden. I'm the founder of Cybermanner, now acquired by DayZ in the earlier part of this year here in Los Gatos, Northern California.
And you're going to take me on a tour of a smart home, yes?
Correct. This is a home that we started in 2016, finished 4 years later, and it's based on our 20-plus years of experience in the smart home market.
All right. Can I ring the bell?
You can ring the bell.
Ring the bell.
Since the doorbell rings, of course you want to hear that, but you may also want to hear that on your phone. You may want to see who it is on your phone. You then may want to let them in based on who it is and the time of day. So with that, let's head on in. So here we are.
Oh, nice.
This is what we call our mini mansion, fondly called the mini mansion. Mm-hmm. Well, we tell our guests on check-in, as soon as you check in, say, okay, Josh, I'm home.
Welcome home. Michelle and Gordon hope you enjoy your stay.
Shades are rising, the lights have turned on, and the TV just turned on.
Yep. And in the background, slowly, you'll hear the music come on. That is essentially take somebody from rainy, wet, cold outdoor, sit on the doorstep, open the door, three words, and the comfort of light and the comfort of heat and the comfort of sound is all there for them within seconds of their arrival. We have a TV that actually comes from, the screen comes from the ceiling. So now you have, in a matter of less than 30 seconds, you have a combination of a 90-inch screen that's directly in front of the bed. So if I go to the skylights and I hit the skylight open button. Now these are a little bit lower, but in the downstairs area, you can see those skylights are about 17, 18 feet above your head height. So it's not easy to manually turn those up and down. I always like to say, this is sometimes my favorite room in the house. So now when I turn on this shower, and I turn it on from here, from this little touch screen, and I hit start the shower.
Why is that better than just turning the valve on?
It actually has a his and her setting for the temperature of the shower, meaning that when I turn on the shower like I did by touch screen, or even by voice when I wake up and get out of bed, and I say, Josh or Alexa, turn on the shower, it will turn on the shower, and when it reaches the set temperature point that you've specified, it actually turns off, meaning that then when you step in the shower and turn it on, it's exactly the temperature you want. Even the toilet that's over here, you know, if you're going to be close to the toilet, most likely you want to use it. So the toilet lift that comes up.
How is artificial intelligence making smart homes smarter?
Fundamentally, what AI means is that it takes the information that it knows about you and the way that you live and tries to enhance that through that unique knowledge of your own living patterns. Mm. And of course, there's challenges with that relating to your privacy, relating to the fact that your living patterns are not always consistent. But all in all, like the bed that's upstairs, the pattern it recognizes coming from Bright Bed, it recognizes that you sleep a certain way and your partner sleeps a certain way. And if you collect enough data on the pressure points, so the way your body interacts with the mattress over a number of weeks, 2, 3, 4 weeks, the mattress can actually predict what those pressure points are to improve your sleep. That list is almost infinite, and it's really, you know, a big part of the attraction is trying to create something so that the house is really kind of your personal assistant. It's kind of your to co-pilot you through the way you want to live your best life.
Thank you so much for the smart home tour. I learned a lot. Okay, Josh, I'm leaving.
Thank you for visiting the Control 4 certified showroom powered by Josh. The forecast is partly cloudy with a high of 62 degrees.
By the way, if you'd like to stay at that smart home in Los Gatos, it's listed on Airbnb. Coming up, companies large and small are leaning into AI. We'll explore how they use it and how they aim to use it responsibly.
Listening to Artificial Revolution, an Odyssey conversation on KYW News Radio. Back to Artificial Revolution, an Odyssey conversation on KYW News Radio.
AI has been making innovations and problem solving easier for many businesses. Tech analyst Ben Beharin is CEO of Creative Strategies, a consulting firm. Ben, how have you used the current AI technology for your business?
You know, my company, you know, we use a lot of third-party software, but we've actually found that for some of our internal processes, whether that's part of our research flow, part of our data collection flow, we've actually been experimenting with just writing our own internal software. And it's things that I just, you know, were like, hey, it'd be great if we could do this, but I'm never going to pay, right, $50,000 to $100,000 for somebody to go write me custom software. Like, we can actually do in days now with just generative AI. The tools are starting to exist now that just get you to do a prompt, you slightly edit it, and it will get to your end result with software, for everything from Mac apps to iOS apps to cloud to software to service apps. It's pretty impressive. So that to me, and like I said, this is new. This is, you know, within the last, you know, 6 to 8-ish months, where we've just sort of seen this. You don't need to know how to code to write software. And I believe that's a very, very disruptive idea to a lot of public companies, businesses.
This innovation has also expanded to another business experience that we all have: shopping. Not just for efficiency, but also for the fun of it. Holly Kwan with Odyssey News Station KCBS went to check out the latest innovations seen in stores.
If you thought online shopping was easy, now comes the next step in brick-and-mortar commerce.
With Amazon One, you can enter, identify, and pay with just your palm, whether it's getting to the gym, picking up...
USC Professor Emeritus Gerard Medioni is an Amazon VP and distinguished scientist who helped design the palm reading technology. On a video posted by Amazon Science, he says it's about solving the problem of the time suck.
Go look for your credit card. Or you need to fish for your phone, and you know, it creates friction. What we want to do here is give customers time back.
You link your credit card to a scan of your palm and you're done.
First thing is that you're in control. Each time you use Amazon One, you intentionally need to put your hand over the device to scan your palm for it to work. So you get to decide exactly when and where to be recognized.
In the last year, these palm readers have been in place in more than 500 Whole Foods stores, which enjoys a loyal customer base. But these Oakland shoppers aren't ready to hand over their hands.
I've seen it for the past year, and I haven't, it's funny, I haven't been able to move myself towards using it. I do use the Retina for the iPhone, right? And we do use the fingerprint for the iPhone and other things, but for some reason, I just haven't been able to entrust that with Amazon.
I tried the Amazon stores where you can kind of go in, personless shopping, and
just walk out.
It was fine, not great. If I had a question, I'm kind of, you know, stuck searching on my phone for. And I look forward to seeing people in the grocery store, not just, you know, people who are also shopping, but people who work at the grocery store, and, you know, be able to kind of say hi.
If we're going to introduce these technologies, they have to work really, really well.
CBS tech analyst Ian Schur.
Amazon's thing, it's an interesting idea, but I think part of why it hasn't caught on broadly, and by that I mean outside of Amazon, is that kind of discomfort with a new technology. You know, I've been using Apple Pay and Google Pay since they came out, essentially. And still to this day, when I use my watch instead of my phone, people give me a look, but they're totally used to it with the phone.
Cashless payment, driverless cars, it's a level of autonomy we still have to get used to.
A great example I was taught many years ago was that, you know, one of the reasons that elevator companies had people standing in the elevators initially pushing the buttons and operating the elevators was not because they needed someone to be there to push the buttons. We all know how to push buttons, but it was to make people feel more comfortable with the idea that someone was in charge of the elevator, right? And that it was safe. And I think that the way we look at these things changes over time, but we have to be proven those trusts.
Who likes beer? Come here.
Coors Field, just the latest MLB park to install pay-by-palm technology. But then where's the fun in being tossed a cold one from the vendor? Back at Whole Foods.
Apple Pay on my phone is just as fast. But then now you're having Apple have access to all your credit cards and stuff. So it's like, what do you want to give up, you know? What level of freedom do you want to have computers take over for you?
I choose to come to the grocery store. We have Amazon for free this month, Whole Foods delivery for free. And I just want to... I don't know. There's something about being here, being around people.
Touching the fruit.
Touching the fruit, seeing the things that we like, smelling it. I don't know. I just don't want to go to this point in my life where everything is done via phone and via digital.
Everybody's using AI for what? To make art, to make music, to do all this stuff, to take away from people's work and stuff. It's like, that's all things that humans should do. So why is it that we're having a computer take away that elements that create the creativity of people?
At a certain point, we have to ask, what society are we building? Are we chipping away at the foundations of civil society by lessening our interaction with each other, reducing the amount of time and meaningfulness of our connections?
So, what do the thought leaders at the big tech firms think about the opportunities and challenges with AI? After his Waymo ride, Mike DeWald with Odyssey News Station KCBS also made a stop at San Jose State, where many are discussing this specific topic.
While there are plenty of worries about the technology, those who have worked in the field since AI was in its more simplistic form say it's a powerful and positive tool.
These visions of, you know, some Terminator taking over the world or, you know, some AI trying to make everyone make paper clips is not something that's going to actually come to reality.
Ashmeet Sadana is a venture capitalist who's been investing in AI for nearly a decade.
There are some issues that have to be solved, but it's going to be a huge boost in productivity, and overall AI is going to be very good for us as an economy, as a country, as the world, as we improve productivity and get the benefits of that.
He sees the biggest positive impact in automation, as well as in taking care of the more tedious white-collar tasks.
I think AI is a generational technology. It's going to have an impact just like the internet, just like the desktop PC, the smartphone. These were all massive impacts on our economy.
Still, he says there's a growing need for the innovation to be made responsibly.
I'm not scared of AI. I'm more scared of the person behind the AI who's going to try and use it. Like any technology, people will try to use it maliciously.
San Jose State University, in the heart of Silicon Valley, the site of the Responsible Innovation in AI Summit, bringing together investors, developers, students, and faculty to tackle the issue head on. Anu Basu is professor of entrepreneurship at San Jose State.
We're so lucky to be where we are, right? We have people from NVIDIA, from Google Gemini, from all the big companies coming here, entrepreneurs, VCs, and they're talking about what they're doing, what lies ahead, you know, and what are the possibilities. So that's really exciting, and I think it's inspiring for our students and the community.
Lakshmi Shankar is a former developer, now a VC himself. He helped build Twitter and Google Gemini.
Imagine the future when it's going to be around ability to really deeply reason with you and have infinite memory, infinite patience, and also for you to be able to talk to it.
With AI innovation happening so quickly, Shankar argues that pace is ultimately a good thing.
Overall, I think with the right guardrails, it's a good thing because it is a moment in time where you try to hold on and you try to basically make sure that you're building responsible products with AI that is enabling it and see where it goes.
Tech analyst Ben Beharin, how do you think the big tech firms and developers of AI are handling these guardrails?
I think it's good that everybody kind of chasing down this path has a philosophy of responsible AI. You know, you hear it talked about, you hear it debated. They're trying to keep accountability, and you even just see, right, some of the big companies putting very specific guardrails on some of these technologies in order to account for that safety.
Coming up next, we look at how AI is being used in school and in your health.
We'll be right back to Artificial Revolution, an Odyssey conversation on KYW News Radio. This is Artificial Revolution, an Odyssey conversation on KYW News Radio.
Learning in the classroom has evolved at a breathtaking pace in recent years, largely fueled by AI's increased use in school. Jeffrey Schaub with Odyssey News Station KCBS sits down with a student who is using AI.
Claire Considine is a 12th grader at St. Ignatius High School. She will enter college next fall.
I plan to pursue medicine in college, and I want to major in something that will allow me to go to med school, hopefully, in the future.
And she says AI has helped her become better prepared. We spoke with Claire outside a coffee shop in San Francisco's West Portal neighborhood.
The main forms of AI right now are ChatGPT and Gemini, and these forms of AI, you can pretty much ask it anything, it'll come up with a response, and then you can make it like make it one sentence, two sentences, ask it to do all sorts of different things that really make the request super specific, which is different from unlike anything before, because most of the time on Google it kind of gives you a broad answer and you have to dig deeper into websites to find your more specific answer.
She showed us how she uses AI, in this case on her smartphone. She asks Gemini to summarize part of the classic novel To Kill a Mockingbird.
Write me a thesis statement about chapter 2, and it would know I'm already talking about how to kill a mockingbird because that's what the conversation's about. So it comes out with a short and sweet thesis, more detailed, focusing on a specific theme. So it really does break it down and makes it, for me especially, as someone who's needs to kind of just see it and be organized, it allows me to break it down and see kind of like, here's the short version, here's a more detailed version, and then here's something that I could like relate to, like the overall arching theme of the story.
But you could also just copy and paste that if you wanted.
So, yes, you can definitely.
Which would be a no-no.
Yes, that would be a no-no, and that would be considered using someone else's work.
At St. Ignatius, Claire says teachers can use something called an online AI generator to make sure what students submit is their own work rather than from artificial intelligence.
If I was to just copy and paste this like short and sweet thesis statement into my school for my teacher to see, they could probably go put it in a generator and would say it's 100% AI generated. And that's what many teachers do. Not all teachers do. So some students do get away with it, but a lot of teachers know. And also it does come off as a robot. It does not sound like a human wrote it.
But overall, she says AI can be a great tool.
As long as you use it effectively and you use it with the intention to help you become a better student, ultimately, then I think it's a great resource and a lot of people should consider trying it.
The internet has been around now for decades, but it's playing a major role in AI's recent growth. When it comes to things like helping with school, tech analyst Ben Beharin.
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of the data itself, that was a pivotal part, right? Because you look at these models and they're essentially trained on the breadth and depth of the internet, which essentially means that if it's on the internet, it can generate an answer for you or a conversation based on a topic. So it's using that knowledge base. I think that's a fundamental piece of this. But again, to your point, right, the internet's been around for a really long time. It's not that that data wasn't there. It's just that we didn't have the compute. We didn't have the underlying algorithms and fundamental architectures to take the breadth and depth of the internet, like, you know, to use the pool of the worlds of information that exists online. And now you be able to have a query, a back and forth with an agent to learn about that, to discuss about that, to search about these things. So that's, you know, the fundamental knowledge base is essentially what exists digitally online. Our ability to query and index that is the fundamental breakthrough that generative AI has changed. That impacts search. It impacts a whole host of the ways we use these things. But that knowledge base is the fundamental reason why we can have these what feel like, you know, conversational formats with these technologies.
The revolution doesn't stop there. It's also changing how the healthcare industry operates, using AI not only on the administrative side, but also with your doctor's decision-making. Brett Burkhardt with Odyssey News Station KCBS says medical science is taking a page from science fiction.
Life is imitating art at Stanford Healthcare. Star Trek predicted it decades ago with a medical scanner for their science fiction doctors.
Star Trek, part of the feature was the technology. We're really excited when the technology blends in the background.
Congestion in both lungs.
An important aspect of artificial intelligence in the medical field.
When I learned, we started with a pencil and paper.
Dr. Christopher Sharp is the Chief Medical Information Officer for Digital Solutions at Stanford Healthcare.
Basically trying to make sure that healthcare technology works for our clinicians in the care of their patients.
He remembers a time when the best doctors were known for a key skill.
How much can you memorize? That's what you need to know. That's the most important thing, is which doctor is the smartest is the doctor that remembers the most of the textbook.
But that carried a big burden.
Because that was all written in paper, it was never seen again. It was just locked up. And it was impossible to really learn from that.
And now?
The textbook is infinite. It's absolutely impossible to understand and absorb all this knowledge. So AI provides an opportunity to be able to surface that knowledge where it makes sense, you know, for doctors.
Dr. Sharp says AI removes a barrier in the patient's hospital room in a way in which you may be able to relate.
If your doctor's turned with their back to you while they're typing in the computer to make sure that they got all the information, you're not going to be happy as a patient. That interaction is not very rich. It doesn't engender trust and really deep understanding.
But AI is allowing doctors to remove that keyboard that has been a barrier to your care.
The doctor now can be looking the patient right in the eye as they're talking about very complex care, knowing that behind them, there's this tool capturing all the important parts and bringing those back into the data set later that is important.
Therein lies the difference between art being front and center in shows like Star Trek and life in this new world of AI in the background.
Because it shows that actually technology can make the human interaction more possible instead of technology that gets in between the human interaction.
Lie on your back.
The promise of better care using AI is not limited to the interactions between you and your doctor.
And we'll start with some range of motion.
It's quickly showing promise in patient imaging.
A radiologist could see certain things on the X-ray highly reliably, but artificial intelligence might have its own way of looking at the X-ray. When you bring the two together, it helps to decrease that miss rate.
And Dr. Sharp is hopeful it will soon help diagnose and treat patients who have symptoms you can't find through a simple blood test.
Could this help us to identify patients who have depression, but they're not telling you?
And while hospital systems like Stanford Healthcare are carefully moving forward with AI technology as just one tool in the toolbox, they are equally exploring guardrails to keep patients safe.
I'm not going to take your data and put it into ChatGPT because I don't know who's going to look at that, right? And if I name you and put down your diagnoses and say, hey, ChatGPT, what do you think? I'm completely exposing your data in a way that is absolutely not okay.
It's the reason why Stanford Healthcare is using its renowned group of health technology experts to build the next generation of care through AI to sidestep the human condition.
All of us tire. All of us miss things from time to time as humans. Being able to bring that extra support into that complex diagnostic decision-making by a machine that never gets tired, never calls in sick, you know, and is always there to kind of back you up, that's something that we think is going to be incredibly powerful.
So while Hollywood may be able to predict outlines of the future, Dr. Sharp will only venture to guess one thing.
I think that none of us know where it's going to be in 10 years, but we know for sure it will be in probably everything we do.
Coming up, we're going to be talking about art imitating art and how AI is being used as a tool to create it.
Listening to Artificial Revolution, an Odyssey conversation on KYW News Radio. Back to Artificial Revolution, an Odyssey conversation on KYW News Radio.
Creative arts has been a major topic in the AI era. So David Welch with Odyssey News Station KCBS sat down with an expert to make music with AI.
Professor Ben Kemp with the Berklee School of Music has a lot of practice. And as his job title tells you, he's good at explaining.
You go over here, there's a button that says create. You click create.
Kemp and I are on a website called Suno.com. It advertises we can make songs about anything.
So what kind of music are you into?
I just listened to some recordings by Count Basie. The professor and I come up with prompts, a big band song about a late night party.
And what happens at the late night party?
It is a song, so someone's falling in love.
Our old friends rekindle a love. Okay, so that's all that we had. That's all the work that we had to do.
15 seconds later, the song is born.
Moonlight grace the midnight sky.
Clearly, I'm not winning a Grammy. And Kemp shows me that some of my prompts needed refining. After another pass, it started to get closer.
The moon was high. The stars align.
Now, I'm curious, as a songwriter and a musician and a composer, how do you feel about this?
I feel all sorts of ways about this.
AI among art is a polarizing topic. Across mediums, artists are split. On the one hand, there's the origin of creativity. In our case, it's a song. But is it a song if it's a mashup of previous ideas? Then there's the question of when creative license ends. Kemp says he and his classes wrestle with these ideas every day. But he says he always reminds his students that music is constantly innovating.
Technology has played a pretty huge role in music and music creation. I mean, one of the kind of analogs for me is in the 80s, the sampler became widely available.
Kemp is quick to point out that sampling and machine learning do have their differences. But he says it demonstrates the fundamental point. Human interaction is key to creation. He uses a different AI songwriting model to show me.
I went into my digital audio workstation. That's the program that I make music in. And I booted up two of the quickest sounds that I could find. I just grabbed the first two sounds that I had and played something very, very simple and rushed. Barely listenable. Not something I would put on streaming services, but there are notes and rhythms in it.
Kemp doesn't help the composition when he adds a voice that's more of a mumble than a melody, so but when the machine gets a hold of all of it, it spits out this.
I ain't like what I hear. I don't want to hear you anymore. My ears are getting tired. You sound like my ex.
What we have is far from where we started, with Kemp's vocal track making the biggest transition. The machine did all of this, and it was astonishingly fast. But Kemp reminds me that we started with a tune that was and is still pretty bad.
It's a really great and really quick sketch pad. For me to get the last thing that I just played you, the Yacht Rock version with the beautiful vocals on it, if I was with humans, that would be like 2 to 4 hours of work.
The case for AI and art is often rooted in workflow. The machine saves precious time by taking away the tedium, something Kemp thinks benefits musicians. But he worries regulations will stand in the way.
I hope that the AI industry and the music industry, they come together to find a way to allow this technology to be used ethically and responsibly moving forward rather than cut off and stopped.
But as someone that makes his living teaching others how to create, he's just as concerned about artists getting paid for their work.
If I don't want the model training on my songs, I should be able to choose, I don't want the model training on my songs. If the model does train on my songs, and it generates music based on what it learned from me, then I should be entitled to some kind of compensation for that.
But most important, he doesn't think anyone will listen, AI or not, unless the music is good, something he believes only comes with human intervention.
With art often comes science, or at least it feels that way on the job hunt, whether you are looking or if you're the one hiring. Shannon Golden with Odyssey News Station KCBS went along for the journey.
Searching for a new job can turn into a full-time gig. I've been there, and it's top of mind for Keaton Maring, a third-year law student at University of San Francisco's School of Law.
It is a lot, and it is kind of difficult to find jobs that are open or, you know, that I'm going to be qualified to get.
Third-year Brandon's been scouring for internships. internship opportunities.
Honestly, I'm spreading myself very thin across everything, just hoping something bites.
But they both have a trick up their sleeve to try and get a leg up on the competition. ChatGPT, a generative artificial intelligence chatbot that, when given instructions, can provide a detailed response.
I mostly use it for resume and like cover letters.
Brandon uses it to prepare for interviews.
I put what I would say in and see like if it can help make it a little bit more professional instead of just me spewing about my life.
And they're not alone. According to a ResumeBuilder.com survey, almost two-thirds of job seekers these days are getting hired after using resumes and cover letters written by ChatGPT.
We are strongly encouraging students to use AI.
Alex Hockman, director at USF's Career Center, is now coaching students on how to use AI.
But it's pretty obvious sometimes when I'm like, hey, just out of curiosity, like, did you use AI for that cover letter? Like, nothing against that at all, but it looks a little stiff. Like, it looks a little off.
Which is why AI developers are trying to improve the process.
We've built a system that acts as a fail-safe around the typical challenges or typical failure points of a general AI system.
That's Puneet Kohli, CEO and founder of CareerFlow AI, a Silicon Valley startup that built its own AI model customized for a more efficient job search.
We estimate that we save our users at least 10 hours a week.
And AI has saved time for job recruiters, too. The global staffing firm Robert Half has used its proprietary AI model to analyze over 30 million candidate profiles.
AI plays a significant role, I would say, in streamlining tasks like resume screening, candidate matching, and assessing engagement.
Senior Regional Director Jason King says, yes, recruiters can usually tell if AI's been used. And new research shows that job seekers with AI-boosted resumes are 8% more likely to be hired. But according to King, even a strong AI resume can't tell the full story.
Soft skills like communication, adaptability, really aren't easily captured by AI, which is why our recruiters continue to conduct personalized assessments.
Kohli expects we'll continue to see this shift towards incorporating AI in the job hunt.
The resume, in the way we think about it today, is going to become a relic of the past.
And Hockman is hopeful AI might be able to help level the playing field for his students and others.
I do think AI will probably be more fair. I hope I don't come to regret those words.
The big fear almost everyone has with AI is that it's coming for our jobs. So, I have one final test.
I have written 3 scripts based on an event in the news this last week. 2 of them were written by AI. 1 of them, yours truly. So, I'm going to play all 3 and see if our AI experts can identify which is artificial intelligence and which was written by human intelligence.
This store has been targeted by burglars 4 times in recent months. The thieves are using cars to smash through the doors or even attaching chains to rip them open. The owner has had enough. He's bought a van and parks it right in front of his store every night, like a makeshift barricade.
Okay, that's number 1. This is number 2.
The burglars are getting bolder. They're using cars like battering rams or using chains to yank the doors right off the hinges. Fearing for his livelihood, the owner has come up with a unique security measure. He's bought a van and parks it in front of his store every night, blocking the entrance.
And number 3.
Like many businesses along High Street, High Gift, and Mini Market has been repeatedly broken into by criminals who often use vehicles to smash through front entrances. Now, owners are trying to make things harder for the bad guys. They've installed curbside barriers, and overnight they're parking a large van in front of the business.
What do you think? Was it 1, 2, 3? I should say 2 of them were AI. 1 of them was me.
Hi, my name is Georgetta, and I'm an assistant professor of computer engineering at San Jose State. It's not easy to say. Usually people employ automated analysis tools to detect the mathematical properties of the text. I felt the 2 sounded most human and most like you.
Okay. And why?
It was a little bit more colorful.
My name is Neha, and I'm an undergraduate student at San Jose State, and I also work as a research assistant on AI for Social Good projects.
Which did you think were the AI scripts, and which were the human script?
I would also say that the second one sounded more human, but I could be wrong because AI can be manipulated, and with prompt you can make it sound like that it's really human.
So are you ready for the big reveal? I wrote number 3.
Wow.
Yeah. And to be honest with you, it was the worst of the three. The other two, I thought, were better than mine.
So actually, I was on the fence between two and three.
Okay.
I felt that the three had more elements kind of the physical world, like the barricades, etc. But it felt a little long.
Interesting. What does this mean for a future where I, as an English major, wrote this script, and I think the AI scripts were better than what I wrote?
I think that, our initial reaction to AI is one of, wow, this is so good. Is it better than what I'm doing? But the personal experiences and kind of personal emotion and personal goals that we have when we speak bring a lot of value to what is being said. And that is more important. And I feel that AI has put actually more focus on what is human and what is important to us. And so I think over time, we're going to value humanity more and more.
This Odyssey Conversation, Artificial Revolution, is a production of KCBS All News Radio in San Francisco, produced by Michelle Fredrigal and Dennis Foley. Be sure to download the free Odyssey app for more shows like this, your favorite radio stations, and so much more. For Odyssey and KCBS, I'm Matt Bigler.